like to call to order, please, the Tuesday, February 26, 2013 session of the House Ag and Natural Resources Committee. We are in session. And we have several bills that we're going to be hearing here this morning. The first one we carried over from Thursday. We had one witness who was some considerable distance away. House Bill 2782, and Beth, would you refresh our memories what that bill's about?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2782 allows commodity commissions to amend their rules related to the number and geographic representation of commissioners. There is a dash 2 amendment in front of you. On that dash 2, there's no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact.
Very good. I'd like to call up, please, Roger Beyer and John McCauley. Are you? Come on up.
That's a dangerous threesome.
Oh, man.
The Three Stooges?
No, I didn't say that.
Good morning, gentlemen. Welcome.
Me, you go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Mike Dewey on behalf of the Potato Commission. You have testimony that was delivered to you online from Nels Iverson, who's a diversified grower, potato grower in the valley. He was here last week, and he's in D.C., and he was obviously not able to speak to the bill. As I think you probably know, commodity commissions are an Oregon success story. I won't bore you with the details, but they do provide revenue to the growers for research, the extension of that research, trade policies, potatoes, whatever the case may be, consumption. Oregon potatoes are the best in the world. There's no question about it. Idaho is not even close. But to get to the legislation before you, a few years back, we worked on some legislation to restructure the commodity commissions based on a couple court cases and being able to analyze the decisions of these court cases over the mandatory assessment of growers by Oregon statute. And that is the basis by which these commissions are funded. There's a mandatory assessment. So what we had to do is basically rewrite the Commodity Commission law to provide for some state oversight of the various programs. And that would arguably provide some protection for any future litigation on this subject. And there has been none, as far as I know. But what we did is we established temporary commissions. And in so doing, we didn't realize that if the circumstances had changed, which speaks to this bill about the geographical membership of the growers on a commission or the number of growers on a commission, that we had to come back to the legislature. And there was an opinion that said it was written in such a way that we had to amend the statute, and that's why we're here today. Because you will hear that a number of commodity commissions, in terms of the grower patterns, pricing, and the like, you may have 7 members, and you have, in the rules today for the commodity commission, 7 members from certain geographical areas. Well, what happened is the growing patterns have changed in the state of Oregon, and you may not have any growers or substantial growers in a particular area. So this bill rectifies what we thought we were doing initially in terms of setting up the geographical representation. So we commend this bill to you. We support it. We don't think it's controversial. There's an amendment to the bill. Others will speak to that. But we hope that this bill can move forward. I'd be happy to answer any questions, however you want to do this, Mr. Chair.
Thanks very much. I think what we'll do is we'll go through the panel, and then we'll ask you all questions after you've finished.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. I'm Roger Beyer. I'm here representing the Oregon grass seed industry, which has, there are 4 commodity commissions in that industry. Also the Oregon Blueberry Commission and the Oregon Dairy Farmers Association, all that are supported somewhat by commissions. I'll speak specifically to the Dash 2 amendments, which is in front of you, and it is because probably one of the grass seed commissions and the dairy commission that this amendment is needed. There may be others, but if you recall, maybe those of you who were here the last session, there was a bill that did away with the Highland Bent Grass Commission, and part of that legislation instructed the Fine Fescue Commission to start assessing Highland Bent Grass, and part of that, our testimony at that time, was that the Fine Fescue Commission would add a Highland Bent Grass producer to its commission in order to so that commodity could be represented in that commission. They did that. You passed the bill, the Highland Bent Grass Commission away, the Fine Fescue Commission brought in a Highland Bent Grass producer to represent that industry on that commission, and after that was done, the Department of Justice came to them and said, we think the statute didn't necessarily allow you to do that. So you passed a bill instructing them to do that. There was another statute out there that said they didn't know if they had the authority to do that. So that's why we are here with the Dash 2 amendments. This is a conformity amendment which says that what they did is legal, and you guys are going to bless it.
Mr. Beyer, you came to the right place. We're here to fix it.
So with that, there are other commissions I know that since have expressed interest or have actually changed makeup of their commissions, the Dairy Products Commission being one of them. You're somewhere in the last 10 years changed the makeup of their commission. This new Department of Justice puts that in question. Therefore, the Dash 2 amendments would authorize what they have done and continue it going forward. So we commend to you House Bill 2782 with the Dash 2 amendments. I would ask you to move them through the process so we make sure that our producers are both represented and what they are doing is absolutely in accord with the statute. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm John McCulley. I'm here representing the tree fruit industry, and the commission that we work with is the Oregon Sweet Cherry Commission. I also am administrator of three different commodity commissions, the Orchard Grass Seed Commission, the Clover Seed Commission, and the Oregon Processed Vegetable Commission. We do support House Bill 2782 for the reasons that you've heard. It really is more of a technical fix, I think, than anything substantive, but still it's a very important fix to make. I would also recommend the Dash 1 amendment, which is an emergency clause. There are several commissions in a position now where they are needing to change their makeup of their commission from a geographical standpoint. I think the Potato Commission is one. I think the Sheep Commission is another. So they would appreciate having the ability to do that as soon as possible. I can give a real practical example of the impacts of this bill. The Processed Vegetable Commission, we used to have a representative on our commission from Malheur County when Orida had a corn processing plant in eastern Oregon. When that corn processing plant no longer existed, there was no growers in eastern Oregon, so thus no need to have a commission member represent people who didn't grow anything. So we think that this is a good bill, and as I say, it really is more of a technical fix than anything, but it's an important one to pass forward. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. John, you threw us a curb. You saw all the whispering going on here while you were testifying. Committee members, I think that Dash 1 amendment that Mr. McCulley referred to is contained in the Dash 2.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
First mistake you've ever made.
It is. So right there.
So you can see we're all paying attention, though.
Wow.
So
you actually read
that? So with that, are there questions or comments for this distinguished panel? Representative Whitsett, please.
I just have an odd question. Why was the Department of Justice investigating this and the Bentgrass Commission anyhow? I mean, how did that come to their attention?
Mr. Chair, Representative Whitsett, I guess the best I can tell you is there had been an attorney with the Department of Justice who had represented commodity commissions for some time. That person went on and to do something else. They brought in a new staff attorney to represent the commissions. The new staff attorney, as that person was looking through the statutes and what commissions had done, identified what they thought was a glitch in the law.
Okay.
So a change of attorneys is the best answer.
Thank you.
Representative Reardon.
Mr. Chair, is there a commission that covers prunes?
Mr. Mr. Chair, Representative Reardon, there used to be. And I think the legislature discontinued that six, 7 years ago.
Yeah.
There used to be.
Don Schellenberg would know that.
They were meeting irregularly, so. I knew we couldn't dodge that bullet.
Chair Woods.
Vice Chair McHugh,
for the benefit of the panel, I'm not sure you are aware that Representative Reardon carried the prune bill to the floor last week. So it's been a point of conversation for quite a while now. And it lingers on.
He distinguished himself.
He did a fine job.
Yes, he did. He certainly did. And a very good sport about it as well. Anything further? I'm not seeing anything. I appreciate your testimony very much. We understand that time is of the essence, and we're going to do our best to have this out of here by possibly 8:20 this morning. Thank you very much. Is there anyone else from the public who would like to testify on House Bill 2782 this morning? Last and final call. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2782. And I am going to open a work session on House Bill 2782. And I'd like to recognize Vice Chair McEwen, please.
Chair Witt, I move to adopt the -2 amendment stated 22113.
Vice Chair
House Bill 2782.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair McEwen moves the adoption of the -2 amendments dated February 21st, 2013 to House Bill 2782. Discussion on that motion. Seeing none and hearing none, is there any objection to the adoption of the -2 amendments? Again, seeing none, so ordered. Recognize Vice Chair McEwen.
Chair Witt, I move House Bill 2782 to the floor with a due pass as amended recommendation and that it be placed on the consent calendar.
Thank you very much. Vice Chair McEwen moves House Bill 2782 to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended and that it be placed on the consent calendar. Discussion on that motion. Seeing none, is there any objection? So ordered. Thank you very much. And I am going to close, I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2782. Thanks very much, committee members. And we'll wait just a second here as we get the witness sheets for the next bill. Thank you very much. I am going to open a public hearing.
Do we want to do public?
Yeah, I think so.
I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2250 and House Bill 2251. They both deal with the landowner preference program. I'll open those public hearings. Beth, could you tell us a little bit about those two bills?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2250 would extend the sunset on the landowner preference tag program to January 2nd, 2024. There is a -1 amendment in your packet. And House Bill 2251 would remove the sunset on the Southwest Oregon landowner preference pilot program.
Thank you very much. And with that, I'm going to call up, please, Ron Anglin and Kurt Melcher. ODF&W. Good morning to you both.
Morning. Morning, Chair Witt, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kurt Melcher, Deputy Director of the Department of Fish and Wildlife, providing testimony here today on House Bill 2250 and House Bill 2251. As was previously mentioned, both these bills relate to our landowner preference program, specifically House Bill 2250 to the statewide program and House Bill 2251 to our Southwest Oregon pilot program. I wanted to give you a little bit of background on just landowner preference in general, and then we have had a stakeholder group that's been working on this issue, and Ron, Mr. Anglin here will describe the stakeholder group process and the consensus recommendation from that group, and I'm sure you'll hear from several of them here this morning as well. So the Landowner Preference Program, back in the early 1980s, the Fish and Wildlife Commission began to regulate hunting in certain areas of the state with what we call the Controlled Hunt Program. So what the general concept is, there are the deer or elk population in a given area is small enough that it cannot support just unlimited hunting. The commission adopted rules for controlling, basically limiting participation in those areas. And one of the results of that program is then landowners are forced to compete with the general population for the ability to hunt on their own property. And in many areas, there are far more individual people who would like to hunt in a given area than there are tags available, so they're highly competitive and literally drawn on a lottery basis. So in the early 1980s, the legislature and the department created the Landowner Preference Program, which essentially guarantees tags to landowners to hunt on the property that they own, so that a large landowner in a given area would qualify for tags every year and would not be excluded from hunting on their own property. The program has evolved over the years. There's been a number of legislative changes that have been made, and I won't go into all those details here today. And it's had a series of sunsets as well. The current program, we have about 6,200 landowners that participate in the program, and the program, statewide program, pieces of the statewide program will sunset on January 2nd, 2014. The Southwest Pilot Program that we referred to is in Southwest Oregon, where we had areas with increasing elk populations, particularly in the Rogue Valley, but also other areas with high levels of damage, but relatively small ownership patterns, small in terms of footprint of the acreages. Individuals in those areas were not qualifying for landowner preference tags because their acreage ownerships were generally too small. As the Southwest Oregon Pilot Program was developed, I believe, in 2005, and which basically allowed for no minimum acreage. If a landowner was suffering damage, elk damage, they qualified for tags regardless of their minimum acreage, and those tags could be essentially reauthorized. So there was not a set limit. They were held to I believe it's two at a time, but when those tags were filled, if they were still suffering damage, they could qualify for additional tags. We brought these two bills forward, extending the sunset on the statewide program, and we were recommending eliminating the sunset on the Southwest Oregon Pilot Project. And then, knowing that we had a stakeholder group working together, we expected that we may, if there was consensus among the group, come forward at some point with amendments to these placeholder bills, if you will. So I'd like to turn it over, Mr. Chair, to Ron Anglin to talk a little bit about the process as well as the specific recommendations, and then I wanted to follow up with just a few words after Mr. Anglin.
Morning, Chair Witt, members of the committee. For the record, Ron Anglin, Wildlife Division Administrator. Starting last fall, we did pull together a group of landowners and hunters to specifically look at landowner preference bills. Consisted of the Farm Bureau, OFIC, Oregon Cattlemen, Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, Oregon Hunters, Oregon Bow Hunters, and Oregon Foundation for North American Wild Sheep. We met several times. We had people that were from Burns, people from Hood River, and people from Coos Bay that traveled to these meetings. We met here in Salem, and we really had a very good discussion about the landowner preference program, what worked, what didn't work from the landowner's perspective, from the hunter's perspective. There were a lot of things on the table. There were discussions about hunting in the whole unit by the landowners with LOP tags. There were discussions about tying LOP tags to population management objectives. There were discussions about changing the Southwest Oregon elk pilot program to the whole state and expanding that to deer, elk, and antelope. So the group really came in with lots of asks, if you will, and over the course of about a 2.5 month period of time, they really boiled down what was important to them, and there, quite frankly, were some concessions made by both sides that resulted in what we'll have for recommendations in an amended bill. particular set of bills. And, you know, it's important to note that these recommendations are linked together. So we do have, right now, two separate bills, but the group viewed those as a package. So, you know, if 2250 moves forward as amended, the 2251 recommendations are linked to that, and we're asking that those both move forward together because those are the agreements that were reached within the group. So the specific changes that the group did settle on was some changes to the definition of immediate family. This was actually to bring the LOP statutes in compliance with some direction that had occurred from then-Governor Kulongoski, and we just hadn't captured that within our statutory language by adding domestic partner and some of the in-laws to this. Everybody was in agreement that the sunset dates, they didn't want to have no sunset. They didn't want to have too long of a sunset, so they felt that both bills needed to run for another 5 to 6 years and then sunset again. Gives a good chance for review. So recommending, as you'll see in our testimony, at the bottom of page 1, 2020 sunset date for both of them. They discussed a lot about damage, and in the regular LOP program, landowners are allowed to exchange or split their tags 2-for-1. They have unused tags for damage purposes for deer and elk. There was discussion about removing that from the regular LOP bill, and the landowners were very concerned about giving that up. So in exchange for giving that up for elk in the regular LOP, it was agreed that the Southwest pilot would be expanded to the rest of the state for elk only. So for damage purposes, dealing with elk damage, Southwest pilot and the things that have worked within that would be applicable in the rest of the state. One of the other big things was that landowner preference tags for mule deer only for the buck hunts would be linked to population management objective. There was discussion about this being the case for both deer and elk. However, the group in their negotiations did negotiate to only at this point in time recommending moving that forward for deer. So in a unit, if we're below population management objective, the way the group expressed it and what we would propose in our amendments is that the commission would have authority to put a cap, if you will, on the landowner buck tags. And if there's more landowner interest than what is available under that cap, then the landowners would have a draw amongst themselves for the tags that would be available for them. And that formula would be set by the commission, gives them flexibility, also gives the department flexibility to decide if there's some hunts in particular that shouldn't be included in that. And then the last piece was a big discussion about tag distribution. Right now it's limited that landowners can give about a third of their tags to non-family members. There's a lot of discussion about making all of those tags available to non-family members, but as part of the negotiations and the gives, the group finally settled on 50% of the tags would be available to non-family members. So like I said, there was a lot of really good discussion amongst the group. They really did a lot of give and take, and these were the final recommendations that came out of that group that we'll be preparing amendments for.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, for the record, Kurt Melcher, Deputy Director of the Department of Fish and Wildlife. And I wanted to also add that, so you have in your materials the Dash 1 amendments for House Bill 2250. Those are the recommendations from the stakeholder group. You do not have any Dash 1 amendments for 2251. And the reason for that is we had a relating to clause problem. The relating to clause on House Bill 2251 is relating to the Southwest Oregon pilot project. Therefore, we were not allowed to amend it to be a statewide program. So we're right now been having discussions with the chair and others on the appropriate vehicle. So we're going to be looking for either a existing bill with the appropriate relating to clause or some other vehicle to essentially roll this whole program up into one bill to bring back for your work.
And gentlemen, I would presume that suggests that we wait until there's maybe everything is rolled up before we would move either piece of this.
Mr. Chair, I think as Mr. Anglin mentioned, this was a package deal,
yes,
if you will, and I think that would be appropriate.
Okay, very good. Appreciate that that clarification. Vice Chair Esquivel.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Ron, would you go over the management objective and that process of how it works? Most people on this panel are pretty new. So when you speak of management objective, I think that you need to educate us a little bit on that issue, on how you arrive at it and how it's done.
Certainly, Chair Witt and Representative Esquivel. The Commission has directed the department to work in cooperation with landowners and the hunting community at the local level to develop population management objectives for each one of our big game management units. And they're wintertime objectives, and usually, you know, they started in Eastern Oregon, kind of tied with a lot of the LOP and the controlled hunt process. But they're designed to get at, you know, a combination of tolerance by the landowner and by the hunting community on how many animals will be in a unit. Every 5 years, we sit down again at the local level. We'll have work groups on each wildlife district that will go through the population management objectives with the appropriate landowners and hunting folks from within their local area, and they will develop new recommendations that will then come back to the Commission for approval and serve as our template and what we guide or what we base our hunting seasons on and our tag recommendations on. We're actually going to be reviewing those later this summer and into the fall. Well, probably not into the fall during hunting season, but we will start this summer the process of reviewing those and getting those back in front of the Commission because we're due to do that. We set last time we did this, for the first time, we had the landowners and the hunters review our deer numbers and our elk numbers at the same time. We'd never done that before, so that, you know, we can look at it more big picture on the total impact that deer and elk might be having on private land and on forest land, and then the hunting opportunity associated with that. That gives us then a management target, if you will, and we design, whether it's hunting seasons, whether it's damage programs, whether it's you know, predator populations, we design different things from a management implementation standpoint that will try and get us to and maintain the population level that was set by the Commission. Did that help, Representative Esquivel?
Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we're changing this every year. Is that what we're saying? That could change. It could go down or it could go up depending upon what the agreement is in the particular unit. But do we have any record of where we were 10 years ago with an elk population as per today, what we have for our total elk population as a whole?
Chair Witt, Representative Esquivel, no, we do not change it every year. We review it every 5 years, and we can make decisions at that point in time whether it would be changed or not. We do have population estimates in relation to management objective that date back. The management objectives were first established back in the 80s, but the population objective, or the population estimates, we have date back into the 50s and 60s.
Okay, but do we have more of a population today than we did 10 years ago with Rocky Mountain elk and Roosevelt?
With elk in particular, Chair Witt and Representative Esquivel, in general, we do have more elk, Rocky Mountain elk, today than what we did about 10 years ago. or 15 years ago for sure, we were over objective in a lot of units, and starting in the mid-90s, we started reducing those populations back down to management objective. So a management objective is not necessarily what the habitat is capable of supporting, but it is more of a social number that is set at the commission level after discussions with all the affected landowners.
Vice Chair McKeown.
Thank you, Chair Witt. It would be helpful to me, being new, is how is the damage assessment done? What types of damage? How is it reported? Is it just self-reporting, or does somebody
verify?
Talk to me about how the damage is determined.
Certainly. Chair Witt, Representative McKeown.
McKeown. And you get a pass. Everybody gets a pass.
Just once, all right?
Once. Yeah.
Well, I'm using McCallan's down in the Klamath, so.
Sure. Thank you.
I'll say it depends. And the reason is that in areas where we have damage, we have a history of damage that dates back, you know, sometimes 15, 20 or more years. And at the local level, we don't need to go out and verify that. We've been working with those landowners or landowners in that area, and we know the time of the year when damage occurs. We know reasonably what's going to happen, and you know, whether it's fence impacts by elk, or it's deer elk moving on to fresh pastures, or moving into you know, third cuttings of alfalfa, whatever it may be. We've got a history with a lot of landowners on that. Where it gets probably more complicated and we need to do more verification is where you end up with smaller ownerships, and a lot of that is on the west side. And then if we don't have a history in that area, then we typically would go out, either discuss over the phone, and depending on what people describe to us, we can make a call over the phone, whether it's actually damage or not, or depending on the circumstances, go out and visit the site and look at it with the landowner and determine whether it is or is not damage, and then what the options are for dealing with that. From an agency perspective, we always try and find the least invasive means of dealing with damage first. So, you know, if we can offer advice or educate somebody on dealing with damage, no matter what the critter is, that's what we try first. And we always look at a lethal removal or something like that as a last or worst case option.
Follow?
Please.
So as a landowner within a city limit, with an elk herd that occasionally wanders down a hill and eats apples and destroys newly planted grass, that wouldn't qualify you for a tag, would it?
Chair Representative McKeown. No.
I didn't think so.
Obviously, within the city limits, things are more, a lot
different.
More complicated, and you know, we have no ability to authorize anybody to discharge firearms within the city limits.
I assume not.
But we have actually worked out in some cases on the fringes of city property where, in working with the city, we have developed some hunting opportunities, but it's under pretty special cases, and we have to be pretty certain that we can do that in a manner that's safe. So you're probably stuck with advice mode on your.
So there's no transfer
situation.
Of tag to a remote area if you have inner city damage. No. Okay. Just checking.
Those wouldn't be transferable over to the
Ochocos, maybe.
I don't even know where she hunts.
It was worth a try.
Representative Krieger.
Well, on this last year, I had a landowner preference for my son, but I had a sixes tag. So we harvested a bull off of the ranch, left the four bulls that were there intact to continue to grow into something besides just spikes. And I'm wondering, do you have any statistics about how many landowners have the opportunity to have a tag, but they don't use that opportunity?
Chair Witt, Representative Krieger, I think I do have it embedded in some of the information that we provided to the group. I'm not sure how easy I can lay my hands on it here. It seems like for elk, I'm going to get it wrong, so I won't give you that number. I'll have to get back to you with that.
What a lot of these private ownerships put these animals in a position to where they're not subjected to being poached. In other words, they're pretty well protected on some of those lands. Do you have any statistics on that? The fact, like that 22 head that are on my place, basically they got through the archery season, they got through the rifle season, they're still there. Now they're going to be dispersing out. Normally that second or third year they move off our property and provide opportunity somewhere else, but it would seem at least that there should be some acknowledgement of the fact that because you take care of the resource, other parts of the people off of our property are going to have an opportunity. And the other day you were in my office, and I think it might be an expansion of this thought a little bit. We're discussing the fact that food plots are going to be coming into effect with the ability to do that in Oregon that we haven't had before, and they're working that out with the Department of Forestry. 71,000 small woodland owners, for instance, at an acre apiece would be 71,000 acres of improved habitat that they would be providing, and I think that will have a positive effect. And so I think we want to make sure that simply because you own land, you have an opportunity for a landowner preference, you do not manage those animals as if they belong to you. I don't. And I think it's a great idea that, in my mind, that, hey, some of them do mature, they go off my place, and somebody half a mile over there, a mile over there, gets an opportunity that wouldn't take place if I hadn't been a steward of that animal for the last 3 or 4 years.
Thank you. Representative Whitsitt.
I just have a question about antelope. Why is there an exclusion on buck antelope and not the females? It seems opposite of some of the others.
Chair Witt, Representative Whitsitt. Drawing an antelope tag probably has worse odds of being successful than winning the lottery. And they're a highly desirable tag, and there's been discussions in virtually every one of the landowner preference stakeholder groups about whether to add buck antelope to the landowner preference program. And because of the high value of those, there's never been an agreement amongst the stakeholders to include that for the landowners. The doe part of it was to specifically get at those cases where there is damage occurring, and we certainly see with some of the agricultural pivots that have gone into eastern Oregon, especially out into some of the southeast desert country, where we have a large number of antelope show up, and it does give some ability for those landowners to deal with some of the damage aspects of antelope showing up on their pivots.
Vice Chair Esquivel.
I'm good now.
You're good? All right. Anything further for this panel? I'm not seeing any. Kurt, if you want to just hang tight, you can, or we're going to call you. You're going to be up again here, I think, in a minute. So, yes, Vice Chair Esquivel.
There is one thing. Well, last year or 2 years ago, we grappled with the survey in the state of Oregon and putting a fine on it if you did not complete the survey. But where are we at on that? Last time I talked to you, we're approaching 90% of the people reporting, whereas we spent $250,000 to $300,000 the prior year and only received about a 42% of participation. Are we doing better than that, or how are we doing?
Chair Witt, Representative Esquivel, you're correct. The mandatory reporting with the fee that was imposed or approved by the commission, the legislature approved that last session. The commission adopted that fee structure for implementation this year, and the postcards that we sent out this winter, we have increase the compliance on the mandatory reporting from roughly 42% to 50% to over 90% on our controlled hunts and 82% on our general season hunts. And that does, as we get that fully implemented and run, that will allow us to generate significant savings by not conducting the phone surveys that we've been doing, which cost us somewhere in the neighborhood of $250,000 to $300,000 a year, or you know, between $500,000 and $600,000 a biennium.
Okay. Anything further? And Kurt, I am going to excuse you.
So,
thank you both very much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Next, I'd like to call up, please, George Houston and Al Elkins. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Al Elkins, representing the Oregon Hunters Association. We were one of the stakeholders on the group. We support the recommendations that Mr. Englund just went over. I want to talk for a minute, if I may, about the process. When we started the process, all those stakeholders were not on the same page. As a matter of fact, I don't even think we were all in the same book. As we went through the process, we had a number of 6 to 7 hour meetings in which we went through a myriad of figures and facts provided by the department based on questions that we asked. And it was the first time we really got a not a picture, but a mural of what existed with the LLP program, how it worked. In relation to that, the numbers of deer and elk in the units and how the LLP program impacted them. It was at this time that we began to get a clearer picture of what was going on. And as the process, as we went through the process, more and more of us got on the same page in the same book. And it was at the last meeting that we discussed the fact that we needed to come to an agreement if we could. And we did, based on some comments made about us being stewards of the land, all of the organizations that were represented there, as well as the ranchers and the Farm Bureau, timber. We all cared about habitat and we all cared about wildlife. And this is the best thing for both, this program. That's where we are. The board has asked me to make a statement, and I will just read it. It's a very short. It says, while the proposed new changes are a big step forward, it still falls short based on the data provided by ODF&W and the state of our existing elk herds. LOP elk tags should also be tied into the overall tag allocation similar to mule deer. And we think that that will be our ultimate goal as this program moves forward, is to tie it not only into mule deer, but to the elk populations as well. And that concludes my testimony.
Very good. Thank you very much.
Good morning, Chair Witt, members of the committee. My name is George Houston. I'm the past president of the Oregon Chapter Foundation for North American Wild Sheep. I've been a member of the LOP Task Force for the 2008 process. I worked on it in 2011. I worked on it this cycle. The hunters asked that the LOP tags that were issued to the landowners be connected carefully with the management objectives for mule deer and elk in those particular units. We did that because it absolutely does not make sense to have units either east or west of the mountains where the ungulates, the deer and the elk, or the antelope are in having problems on the ground the way it is, and we're limiting controlled hunt tags. We're scaling those back so the hunters don't go out there. But we're issuing LOP tags to the landowners without any consideration to herd composition or the overall health of where the herd's going. And frankly, east and west of the mountain, deer and elk, we've got some places that the herds are in the dumper. They're having some problems. So linking it with management objectives is a really important, significant piece because, as I think Al brought up earlier, we try to be stewards of the land and stewards of the resources on the land just the same way as the landowners do. It's significant to us. With a couple of reservations, as you've heard from other testimony, we were able to come to an agreement with all parties, and I think Ron Anglin's explanation of the process and of the result is pretty clear of where we're trying to go. But the methodology for linking management objectives to mule deer and elk statewide are sound. And that might be a process that the committee would be instructed effectively on if they'd come back and talk to you about that specifically, how the mechanics of that works over a period of time. Any questions or concerns?
Do we have any? Yes, Representative Krieger, please.
I have mentioned, thank you, Mr. Chair, with ODFW staff about one of those animals on some of the private holdings. I think that they're not subject to constant harassment, and they're not subject to poaching as much. Was there any discussion regarding the protection that landowner provides?
Go ahead. Chair Witt, Representative Krieger, we did spend considerable time talking. The landowners had concern about being living next to a partner landowner that liked elk and didn't want anybody to hunt the elk. And consequently, that particular tract of ground becomes some kind of a refuge so that there's no way effectively to get at the elk that are causing damage on neighboring property. And we tried to discuss and figure workarounds on how to make that happen, that's insoluble at this particular time. We weren't able to come up with a process that would amend what's going on to allow for a workaround to put enough pressure on the elk and to move them to a place that they can effectively be worked with.
Okay.
Just a little follow-up. You heard me mention food plots, so we're starting to develop a process for landowners do forest operation to set some of that forest operation land aside specifically as a food plot, which we've never been able to do, trying to provide a better quality habitat. And it's going to be on the west side, mostly for elk. Deer, of course, do take advantage of it, too, and now we have a large turkey population in the South Coast. Do you have any conversation, or what do you think about the concept of those landowners getting into programs that provide not only the habitat that's naturally there on a farm or ranch, but an incentive to create habitat that is specifically for the wildlife, or the cattle, for instance, are excluded?
I don't think we did. Go ahead.
Chair Witt, Representative Krieger, I don't think we had an opportunity to discuss that, but I certainly would be, and I'm sure the members of the committee would be, or the task force would be interested in getting an idea of what your concept is and talk about it.
Thank you.
Vice Chair McCune.
Chair Witt, can you give me a sense of scale relative to the number of overall tags compared to the LOPs for elk?
Chair Witt, Representative McEwen, I think Ron Anglin would be a better expert witness to be able to bring up and talk to you about that. I think he's got it.
Thank you.
Anything further?
Gentlemen, your testimony was excellent, but more importantly, certainly appreciate the fact that both of you and your organizations engaged in a process that has enabled folks to come to some kind of consensus. And disagreement is fine when we start out. That's the basis on which we make improvements. And the fact that both of you hung in there and insisted on making that tie with management objectives is greatly appreciated. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
With that, I'd like to call up, please, Dave Wiley and Mike Dykesick, please. Vice Chair McEwen, can you have your question answered offline?
Yes,
or?
Certainly.
Mm-hmm.
I think we
Thank
should
you.
Pitch in and buy her a blowgun.
Well, okay. Good morning, gentlemen. Welcome.
Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dave Wiley. I represent the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation in this committee that took advisory committee that participated in a stakeholder with respect to these LOPTAG arrangements that you see before you. And it was a political process, a lot of give and take. But I believe that what came out of it is very effective, and so I want to say the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation does support the changes that are being put forward. Like the other two presenters from the stakeholder group, but we'd sure like to see elk included too, because we believe the science applies there equally well. Can I answer any questions?
Thank you very much. I was busy watching my witness list. Did you introduce yourself for the record?
Yes, sir. Okay. Dave Wiley, Rocky Mountain.
Thank you, Dave, very much. Appreciate that.
Good morning, Chair Witt, members of the committee. For the record, Mike Dykesick, Director of Forest Protection for the Oregon Forest Industries Council. I participated also in the process. Mark Wall, our chairman of our Animal Damage Committee, who's a senior forester with Rosebud Forest Products in Coos Bay, also participated in the process. I think in my 14 years with OFIC, this is my third go-round with LOP in trying to find common ground. And I think the testimony from the department and the other participants so far really underscores the fact of it was a long process, but there was give and take, and I think everybody came away this time, so far to as of today, getting or giving something to get to common ground. So I believe all the recommendations that are being moved forward, I understand there's some technical difficulties trying to get them into one, but I think that's the basis of everyone's understanding and support moving forward is all those components are finally melded into one program. So I hope we can all do something to move that forward. To Representative McEwen's,
Thank you.
And Representative Krieger, for OFIC, it's not so much our members, obviously the larger industrial forest landowners, it's not the ability to hunt on their own property, it's more for the damage program. When it was morphed in 1993, it became a very effective tool in order to manage damage. And I think everyone in the room has all been exposed to some issues, frustrations with management of federal timberlands adjacent to managed private lands. A lot of the populations, I think from the hunter community, from the landowner community, recognize that federal lands seem to be managed for late successional species, the owls, the murrelets, and everything else, and they've not really provided any early feral habitat for the deer and the elk. And so they gravitate to manage private lands, and that's where we experience a significant amount of damage. OFIC, since 1986, has conducted a voluntary damage survey for deer and elk on our member lands. It's voluntary, so I can't really provide any benchmarking or anything there. But annually, in fact, next month at the next Fish and Wildlife Commission meeting, I go ahead and report my annual survey results. I've got a couple more days for surveys, but last year there were 77,000 acres damaged as either moderate or severe, requiring reforestation, and at a cost of about $5 or $6 million. This year's numbers, a little fewer number of surveys coming in this year. I think I'm running around 50,000 this year. So anyway, it's a significant problem, and that's mainly where the industrial forest landowners utilize the landowner preference program. Mark Wall has some direct experience with the Southwest pilot project and was very supportive of it, and has actually brought some of our other Western Oregon members that aren't familiar with it to understand what its benefits would be. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Representative Krieger.
You brought up damage, so I couldn't let it pass on our tree farm. It's only 310 acres, but we've had about $400,000 in damage from bears alone. Bears are my least popular critter that we have. And we had a work group that were looking at the total loss on some of the federal land, like up Lobster Creek, and those units were 30 years old with 80% of the trees dead in the unit on federal land, no management whatsoever. Literally millions and millions and millions of dollars. And it's not only the value of the tree at the time, but it's the potential growth in the future that you're losing. And that relates directly to school funding through the tax system. So people need to be aware. Everything has to be managed. You can't let things get out of balance. And the bear are a real challenge. The numbers are amazing on Southern Oregon and on parts of the coast. And you know, it's like sea lions. There's room for some, but you just can't have unlimited numbers.
Can I respond?
Please do.
I appreciate Representative Krieger's reference to the active and essential management needs, and we're talking about deer and elk with these two bills, but whether it be mountain beaver, river beaver, bear, whatever, providing the management tools to retain populations at healthy levels, but also to retain some control methods to maintain damage at tolerable levels is a huge issue for us. So I appreciate the comment.
Gentlemen, we appreciate your testimony as well. Certainly appreciate your helping make the best public policy possible around landowner preference. Thank you for your involvement. And I also want to thank all of the private timber companies in this state that allow the public access to their lands for recreation. Recognize that not only do bears create damage, but the public creates damage, and there's a cost associated with allowing that access. It is greatly appreciated. Thank you very much.
Welcome. I'll pass that along.
With that, next, please, Jim Welch and Bill Hoyt. Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Witt, committee members, Jim Welch, lobbyist for Oregon Cattlemen Association. And just briefly, I just want to just expand very quickly or agree with Representative Krieger in the discussion around damage and how we have, as stakeholders, working in a rather diverse group now that hasn't, since I've come into this building years ago, been working together. Today, it's amazing, and certainly the issues around damage and what certainly concern us as cattle producers, but our ability now to talk and our efforts, we served on the five-year review of the LOP program in the past, and along with the stakeholders and some fairly wild ideas for wildlife coming up, and we're able to talk about them now very civilly and present some possible alternatives, you know, and I think that's why we see some advancement in this. But I just wanted to share that, let each and every one of you know that we are continuing to work around the idea of wildlife damage and how it impacts us economically as single producers, and what it does to this state. And we'll have more information, hopefully, in the future, to this, what the impact is to locally, that damage, and to the state budgets. I think you would be very interested in knowing some of that information and hopefully some very credible information. And with that, I would like to introduce our immediate past president and legislative chair for Oregon Cattlemen's Association, who would like to share with you a little bit of his own personal story. And we're glad to have him on board. Bill Hoyt.
We're glad as well. Good morning, Bill. Welcome.
Chair Witt, committee members, my name is Bill Hoyt. I, as Jim said, I'm the immediate past president of the Cattlemen's Association. I'm also a fifth-generation rancher from Douglas and Lane counties on the west side. And I have also sat on the task force with all of the stakeholders and participated in the negotiation. And I would echo all of the statements that have been made so far. It was a very long process and a very arduous one. We came to some agreement. I think when we left the room the last time, I believe that we were comfortable. We didn't get everything we wanted. I don't think either one of the stakeholders did, but I think we had consensus that what we came up with was the right thing to do today. I represent, personally, I'm probably on both sides of what you've heard already this morning for a couple of different reasons. In about 20 years ago, the Roosevelt elk started to show up at the ranch. We manage about 1,500 acres in one spot and about the same in another, a couple of other spots scattered around. And it was quite a novelty to see that all, and I'm from western Montana, and so Rocky Mountain elk for me was, I grew up with them, and I've seen the changes in that population in western Montana. But now to see the 8 or 10 that showed up in the beginning grow to 100 and now have backed off to about 60 has been an interesting experience for me. I allow hunting on the ranch, but because of the fact that I-5 goes through the middle of the ranch and we're surrounded by neighbors, and my great-great-grandfather never really anticipated that, the liability for us for rifle hunting is fairly substantial. So I have limited the access that I have given to hunters, to bow hunters. But I have been accused, as Representative Krieger has said, of giving a little bit of a sanctuary. We're surrounded by the BLM and by Weyerhaeuser, which allow hunting in those areas. So the elk migrate, especially during the seasons. And right now, they're particularly visible today. And the cow season will end on the 31st of March. And I will promise you that on the 1st of April, they'll be gone. And so they seek managed ground. And one of the things that is interesting about the concept of being able to provide food plots is that food plots, if they're not managed, are going to be no better than the managed ground, because the wildlife is going to seek that managed. And whether you're in eastern Oregon or whether you're in western Oregon, doesn't matter where you are, the wildlife seeks the managed ground because it's more highly productive, and that's what they like. They like clover. They like. And right now, they're on my primary hay fields right now. And so what we have to do is manage this to a point where I think the key word is management. And I'm very much, I work very closely with the department. I respect what they do, and I respect the most of all, what I got out of the stakeholders meetings was the fact that the problems are not very simple. And when you start to look at all of the different factors that have to be taken in by the department, I gain a great deal of respect for the fact that they have to take in so many different personalities, so many different unique situations, and come up with a solution. And it's not always that easy. So for us, we applaud what's being done right now. We like the Southwest pilot project. We look forward to it expanding. LOP, for me, I don't personally use too many LOPs. I'm qualified for 6. And if I use 2, I'm fortunate. Because I bow hunt, the bow hunters are and for me right now, if you wanted to, it's not very sporting, to be honest with you. I can drive you on a four wheeler out, across I-5 and from here to the exit door, you could probably take an elk today. And so, and there's lots of neighbors around, so I limit to bow hunters for that reason. So I applaud what's going on, and I thank the committee and all the people involved in the stakeholders meetings for their work, and I think we have a lot more work to do, but I think we're on the right track. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very, very much. Excellent, excellent testimony. Committee members, anyone? I want to thank both of you as well for your participation in the process. It's very clear that you've gained a new appreciation for the challenges that the department faces in trying to manage our fish and game. But I want to tell you that we gain an appreciation for the multiple resource management that you all undertake as well. And you're good stewards of that land, and there's a reason why those elk gravitate to your lands. And we recognize that your multiple resource management also has a number of costs, including damage. And Jim, we will look forward to those figures, and I think it will help us gain a better appreciation of the job that the landowners of this state do in managing our natural resources for the benefit of everyone, not just the landowners. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
With that, I'd like to call up, please, Katie Fast.
Good morning, Chair Witt, members of the committee. For the record, Katie Fast with the Oregon Farm Bureau. You've heard quite a bit of testimony this morning. I also participated in the stakeholder group, and we are supportive of the package that will be brought forward in some sort of amendment, and look forward to seeing it move forward. I think, as you deliberate on it, I think it is important that there's sunsets put on that, because we are really testing out a few new programs in moving the Southwest pilot statewide, which we've heard a request for that in Eastern Oregon, and also the mule deer moving to a management unit. And it'll give us a good assessment on how those work. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Question for Katie. Like I've told the others, we truly appreciate the time that that you and your organization have given to help craft sound public policy here, and also too the great stewardship and management that your members provide in resource management for this state.
Great, thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there anyone else that would like to testify this morning on either House Bill 2250 or House Bill 2251? Please come forward.
Apologize, I have a bit of the flu, so if my voice disappears, I apologize. My name is Allison Jane Flagg Miller, and I grew up here in Oregon on our family's 7,000-acre cattle ranch in Klamath Falls, and my brother is very involved in the grain commodities here in Oregon, Tony Flagg, with the CEO of United Grain, so we're vested and had some experience with what these gentlemen were talking about, and I wanted to suggest something. Have any of you heard about Aldo Leopold? Any of you? You've heard of Aldo Leopold. Please, those of you who have not, Google him and read what he has to offer with regards to wildlife management and land use management. My father ran our cattle ranch after Aldo Leopold. He is one of our nation's greatest and most famous wildlife and land use biologists. He is now deceased, but his writings are magnificent and highly regarded and highly respected. And I think that if we read that, a lot of the ideas that were generated here would really have something to build upon and improve upon, and we would have less issues and more compatibility and coexistence with our wildlife issues than we currently are experiencing right now. Things are definitely out of balance, and Aldo Leopold can help us focus on getting that back into balance. So knowledge is power, and I offer that to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions before you leave us? I just comment that as part of my freshman college Forestry 101, uh-huh. we had to read Sandhill Almanac, and it was an absolutely great read, and gives an appreciation for all that is wild and natural and our natural resources. So.
Well, my dad, he donated 200 acres of grain out of our 2,000 acres of grain to the deer because it was cheaper than bringing in hunters or chemicals and issues like that. It worked. It worked for us, but, you know, we're eccentric. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Anyone else? Last and final call for our LLP hearings this morning. Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearings on both House Bills 2250 and 2251. And with that, it brings up House Bill 2252. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2252. Beth, would you please tell us a little bit about that bill?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2252 would authorize the Fish and Wildlife Commission to establish multi-year licenses. The bill does have a revenue impact statement that is in your packet, and it has a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you very much. I'd like to call up first, please, Ron Anglin and Kurt Melcher.
Again, Mr. Chair, Chair Witt, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kurt Melcher, Deputy Director of the Department of Fish and Wildlife. And I know we're getting up against the clock here, so I'll talk fast. We've provided written testimony as well. Appreciate the opportunity to talk with you about House Bill 2252. House Bill 2252 does a number of, accomplishes a number of things, and I'll go through those with you here today. The first thing House Bill 2252 does is it allows all active duty military, regardless of their state of residence, to qualify for our resident fee structure. So as in current statute, any active duty military who's stationed in Oregon or who maintains an Oregon residency while stationed outside of the state, those individuals are eligible as and considered residents for the purpose of our licensing program. This bill would extend that the resident fee structure to all active duty military, regardless of their state of residence. We think it's the appropriate thing to do to recognize our active duty military personnel. We also think, frankly, that it's a marketing opportunity for us, and we may actually be able to get some active duty military to come here and hunt or fish in Oregon. And I did want to also mention on the record that this is a concept that Senator Whitsett and I had been discussing for over the last year or so. So I want to give credit where credit is due on this. Additionally, House Bill 2252 modifies our non-resident license agent fee structure. As and I'll give you just a little bit of background. Our non-resident fishing and hunting licenses are fairly expensive products, ranging from $100 or $140 up to over $500 for an elk tag. When those non-residents go to our license vendors and they purchase one of those documents, the license vendor, the agent fee associated with the document is $2. The agent itself gets to keep $1 from that agent fee. And on a product that's valued from $140 up to in excess of $500, just from a business standpoint, a $1 margin on that product is not a very good margin on handling that large sum of cash. But also, and even more importantly, depending on the method of payment, if an individual is purchasing that document with a debit card or a Visa card, our vendors actually lose money on the transaction. So this bill corrects that, raises the non-resident agent fee on the high-value non-resident products to essentially $10. We've heard on this issue from a number, mostly our sole proprietor type vendors, the small operations, that this is a real burden on them, and we'll help them out. The other thing it does with regard to license agent fee is in 2009, when the legislature adopted our juvenile sport pack, the sport pack includes 9 different licensed products. The adult sport pack, the agent fee on those 9 products is $5. The juvenile sport pack, just essentially through drafting, left the agent fee at the standard $2. So we're proposing to reconcile that and have the agent fee on the juvenile sport pack to be the same as on the adult sport pack. When our vendors are delivering 9 different licensed products, we think it's appropriate to have the agent fee at that level. And then lastly, this bill gives the commission the authority to issue multi-year licenses. So right now, our licensing structure and statute is based on the calendar year. We are looking for the authority to issue multiple year licenses, so someone could purchase, say, a 3-year or a 5-year license from our licensed vendors. And we're also looking for the authority to provide some reduced, some discounted rate. So in exchange for the commitment for a 3-year, a 5-year hunting license, the commission would also offer a discount on the equivalent annual fee. There are a number of states that are now doing this, about 10 states, I believe, that are issuing multi-year licenses. Some states offer no discount. You just simply, the only discount is that you don't have to pay the agent fee or go procure the license each year. Other states do offer discount for multi-year licensing commitment. And for us, it's important because we get our federal match, whether it's Pittman Robertson or Sport Fish Restoration, we get that match based on the license year. So when an individual holds a 5-year license, we automatically qualify for that federal fund match each and every year. That is a very fast, high-level overview. I did want to mention on the active duty military license as well. I think in my research, we would be the only state that's currently doing that. With that, Mr. Chair, I know there's probably others here who would like to testify on this matter. Happy to answer any questions.
Okay, great. Representative Krieger, please.
What's the number of licensing agents that you have today, maybe from 10 years ago? Is it steady? Has it gone down? Where are we at?
Sure. Chair Witt, Representative Krieger, currently we have about 480, and these are private licensed vendors located around the state. I believe that number has been relatively flat since we've come online with our point-of-sale system. There is always some annual variability. Individuals go out of business or decide not to sell a license anymore, but I think it's been generally pretty flat, about 480.
I have mentioned, I think, to Ron, I have a free Pioneer license. You know, if you're 70 or over, and over 50 years in the state, rather than continue to issue that even on a 2-year, why don't you just make that a permanent card? It's got your ID number on it, and you wouldn't have to issue anything. Your agent could just use that right off the computer to issue tags in the years you want to get them.
Sure. Chair Witt, Representative Krieger, under this multi-year licensing flexibility, we believe that the Pioneer license, which is what you're referring to, we would be able to issue that for multiple years. Now, whether we issue it indefinitely, I'm not sure, just simply because then we don't have any record of who is still active in the system. When people pass away, we've essentially got licenses out there that are still active. So we'll have to look at that. But this bill would actually give us the ability to do that. And I think from an efficiency standpoint, I mean, I know my father also qualifies and gets a Pioneer license every year. there's no, he'd be able to do it once every 5 years instead of having to go back every year and reissue the license, which saves us a little staff time and also saves the customer some time.
Just on the revenue side, the way I'm reading this, used to charge a $2 fee, want to move it to a $5 fee, and on the non-resident from 2 to 10. So, in the past, they have paid their own credit card fees. We are now proposing that we are going to cover their credit card fees with the increase. Will that go across the board for all licenses, or just for the Sport Pack and the non-resident?
Sure. Chair Witt, Representative McCune. So the what we're talking about in terms of the increased non-resident agent fee is only for the high-value non-resident licenses. So I'll give you an example. We talked about the non-resident hunting license is $140. It will certainly apply to that. Non-resident cougar tag is only $18. We will not be raising the license agent fee on an $18 product. The current $2 fee covers their expenses. On these transactions, and I'm getting to the other part of your question, on these transactions, when one of our vendors sells a product, one of our licensing products, it's entirely on them. You know, they exchange the cash or credit card, they make the transaction, they pay the transaction fee.
Mm-hmm.
We don't pay the transaction fee, they do. Which is the rub, the transaction fee on a high, on an expensive license
is high, yeah.
Far in excess of the agent fee.
Okay, but it's not going to change anything on your just normal hunting license transaction. You're not covering their credit card fee. They're still responsible for that.
Chair Witt, Representative McCune, that's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Vice Chair Escobar.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Did I misunderstand you, or did you say that the current agent fee is $2, but the vendor only gets a dollar? Why is that if it's an agent fee?
Sure. Chair Witt, Representative Escobar. So the agent fee is $2 with every individual license transaction. $1 goes to the agent who delivers the product, and roughly the other dollar goes to the private enterprise that provides the system. So the entire, not only the computer brains, if you will, of the system, but also all the hardware. You know, when a vendor applies to become a point-of-sale vendor, they don't have to pay for the computer terminal. We have a private company that essentially provides that. And so
they're doing on kind of a split.
Exactly.
And then if we go to $10, will that be 5 and 5?
Chair Witt, Representative Escobar.
Like 9 and 1.
The way it's written is a minimum of $750 will go to the vendor delivering the product.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Yep.
Additional questions? I'm just curious, too. Will the multi-year license portion of this bill also cover tag sales?
Chair Witt, members of the committee, our intent here is that no, it would not cover tags. Of course, many of our tags are issued on a control basis, and we limit the number of tags annually. So we're looking here at simply the annual fishing license, annual hunting license, annual combination license, if you will, Pioneer license, some of those standard license products, not the additional tag.
Okay. Just urge you to consider those duck hunters that like to celebrate New Year's Day. That may be a little easier on those folks at some point.
Chair Witt, I think that's an excellent recommendation. These are the things that we want to have the flexibility for the commission to consider.
Very good. Seeing nothing more. Oh, Vice Chair.
I just want to let Representative Kreider know that as of May 19th, I will join you in the Pioneer Licensing Department. And I'm for it. I've waited 65 years for this.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. Next, please, Al Elkins and George Houston.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Al Elkins, representing the Oregon Hunters Association. I'll make my comments brief. We greatly appreciate
Our board members are vets, veterans, and we greatly appreciate the military component of this bill. Also, the other three components that we support. We had questions similar to what the committee did, the board did, in relation to the fee increase, and our questions were answered via email. Similar to what you heard, exactly what you heard today. So we support that portion as well.
Very good. Thank you.
Representative Witt, members of the committee, my name is George Houston. I'm past president of Oregon Chapter Foundation for North American Wild Sheep, and I live in Sandy, Oregon. I'm pleased to testify in favor of House Bill 2252 today. Each July, our organization, along with our partners in ODFW, put on a sheep and goat workshop in the Dalles at the Discovery Center for all of the new Rocky Mountain goat tag holders and bighorn sheep holders. And it is absolutely amazing to me that young service members 12,000 miles away from home send me an email letting me know they want to go to this workshop and trying to provide anything I can to send them information so they can succeed at this hunt. And the ones that are back in country and in back in the U.S. of A. and able to join us in July, they're really terrific additions to our team. Very, very thankful that they're back in the U.S. of A. and that there's programs that they can take advantage of. Your movement here is really, really appreciated by our organization. Thank you very much for considering this and promulgating it into statutory status where it needs to be. Any questions or concerns?
I think Vice Chair Esquivel has something.
Yes, maybe you can enlighten us. How long has other states allowed this? Because I just assumed we did this in the first place with our military.
I don't have that information for you today, sir. The staff may be able to help you with that.
Okay.
I just think this is a great component that our military folks, be they active duty, whatever service branch, or reservist and National Guard folks, really, really, really value this. You know, you don't expect that when you start getting emails from somebody that's a tank commander in northern Iraq, and you start, pretty soon you're conversing with them, and they're out of the field and back in their hooch trying to get a little bit of rest, but what's really on their mind is being able to come home and have an opportunity to succeed in the controlled hunt drawings and get in the field.
Well, the tank commander can do it from a long ways away.
Yeah, that's exactly correct.
Well, I think Kurt Melcher said that Oregon, if we pass this bill, we become the first state in the union to offer this to our full time our military personnel. So,
So I missed that.
Great idea.
It is a great idea. Anything more? Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Dave Wiley, please. And I think we'll call up Tom Wolf at the same time. Tom, you stupid.
Bob?
Welcome back.
For the record, Dave Wiley, Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation. I live in Sublimity, Oregon. And I am a native Oregonian. And a 28-year Army retiree, combat veteran in the Vietnam area. And the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation strongly, strongly supports the position with respect to the soldiers' opportunity to draw a tag and come back and get state license at the resident rate even. And I'd like to point out that during the 28 years of traveling around the United States, there are a few other states that offer military people who are stationed in the state to get a tag, or I should say get a license at the resident rate. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much.
Yeah. Chair Witt, committee members, Bob Olson with Northwest Steelheaders. I'm also representing Tom Wolf with Trout Unlimited. He had to go to a meeting, but he wanted to make sure that we were on the record on behalf of this bill. Our organizations don't always agree on everything. Well, we do agree this is a very important bill, and it would improve customer service and also fine-tune some important business practices of the department.
Great. Thank you both very, very much. While Tom's away, full power to act. Anything from the committee?
Thank you, gentlemen, very, very much. Anyone else from the public who would like to testify on House Bill 2252 today? I'm not seeing anyone. We have an amendment that's not yet prepared, so we're not going to work this bill, but I would like to ask Vice Chair Esquivel if he'd make sure that the Veterans Committee knows about this bill and the important aspect that it applies to our military personnel.
Well, Mr. Chair, you and I shall have that opportunity this afternoon.
Sounds good to me. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2252 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2390. Beth?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2390 would repeal the sunset on current law, which specifies how the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife appoints a person to act as an agent for the purpose of using one or more dogs to hunt or pursue black bear or cougar. There are no revenue impact, no fiscal impact, and no subsequent referral.
Thank you. And to call up, please, Ron Anglin and Kurt Melcher.
Well, good morning again, Chair Witt, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kurt Melcher, Deputy Director of the Department of Fish and Wildlife. Appreciate the opportunity to come here this morning and talk with you about House Bill 2390. Back in 1994, when Oregon voters passed Ballot Measure 18, which prohibited the use of dogs for hunting cougars and black bears, there were exceptions provided that the department or its agents could use dogs to pursue cougars or black bears in for the case of human safety, livestock depredation, or wildlife management purposes. The department has, in fact, carried forward with that and has taken a number of cougar control actions over the last two decades. But more importantly, in 2007, we had a House bill here that clarified the commission's ability to appoint volunteer agents. So while the statute gave the authority for the department or its agents to use cougars, we did not have any authority to appoint volunteer agents. That would be non-state employees. And so in 2007, we had a bill passed here which essentially clarified that, gave the commission the authority to appoint agents. That bill has a sunset of, I believe it's January 2 of 2014, so a little over a year from now, statute sunsets. We are here proposing to you to eliminate that sunset so that we can continue to use agents in our cougar control work. And then I did want to note also that since 2007, the commission has adopted very stringent rules on what it takes to qualify to be an agent, and we have utilized and appointed 27 different agents over the last roughly 6 years. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions. This bill is simply extending the program that's been in place for 6 years.
All right. Thank you. Vice Chair Esquivel.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So when we need to drop the population of the predator in a certain area, say a unit, do we hire these people or are they volunteers?
Chair Witt, Representative Esquivel, it's actually happened both ways, but this bill provides us the authority to do it with individuals who are not employees. So we always have the ability to hire employees, and then an employee is clearly our agent. This bill allows us to utilize individuals who are not state employees, so essentially they're volunteers, and then there are provisions for expense reimbursement associated with the activities.
So there's actually no, like, I'll go in and I'll take 10 cougars out of this unit, but you give me X amount of dollars per cougar.
Chair Witt, Representative Escarole, that is correct. That is not how it occurs. It's not a bounty, if you will.
But it is an outflow of revenue for us in the long run. It have to be.
Chair Witt, Representative Escarole, certainly it would, to my knowledge, none of this work occurs entirely for free.
Nothing free.
That's right.
Thank you.
Question. Anyone else? Yes, Vice Chair McEwen, please.
Thank you, Chair Witt. Just so I understand this clearly, so these are volunteers, in essence, that we pay their expenses to take care of a population that's of concern. Can that individual, in essence, use that opportunity to act as a guide?
Chair Witt, Representative McEwen, no. The statutory language is very clear that they are doing this work on our behalf. They don't get to retain any animals. So when they harvest a cougar, so if we say we have a livestock depredation issue in a focused area, and we have a volunteer agent who goes out and pursues and removes that particular cat, they don't get to keep the cat. They have to turn that over to us.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification.
Representative Elder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When we have pilot programs and we decide to extend them, do we do any research or kind of analysis to figure out whether or not the program that we had in place was working? Did your department do any of that work before you decided that we should and need to extend?
Chair Witt, Representative Unger, we certainly worked with our local staff to figure out, are we using this particular provision? So, for instance, if over the last 6 years we had not utilized a single volunteer agent, then I expect we would be letting this bill or the statute sunset. In our case, we have used volunteer agents, 27 of them over the last 6 years. And so, in that extent, I guess I would say that was our review in effect.
Quick please. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Was that the original reason why we sunsetted the bill to begin with, was to see whether or not we would use the services of these volunteer agents?
Chair Witt, Representative Unger, I have not reviewed the legislative record on that, nor was I in the seat at that time. I suspect it was that it was a subject of some negotiation to ultimately to allow the bill to move forward. I'm sure there was concern that that the program was going to run rampant or go out of control or something. So the sunset is a natural way to provide that.
I'm interested. We had a fair amount of discussion on our earlier bills with the LOP and how management objectives come to bear. Does the department have a means of checking on a regular basis, be that annually or biannually or however, on how the hunts that are allowed on these particular cats is, does this bring the population into agreement with our management objectives?
Chair Witt, I'm going to let Ron answer part of that question, but I'll give you a little high-level overview. I think right now it looks to us like the cougar population in Oregon is fairly stable at a relatively high level, roughly 6,000 animals. We have the state broken up into management areas for cougars, so we have a zone quota, and when that zone quota is achieved for any particular zone, then that zone closes, and we basically close harvest in that area. We've not generally achieved zone quotas, although there have been a few examples over the last 5 or 6 years. And I'd be happy to let Ron add anything in that I may have missed.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, for the record, once again, Ron Anglin, Wildlife Division Administrator. First off, we don't use the agents in any hunts. You know, they're not for hunting purposes. We have a whole hunting season structure that that occurs in. So the agents are what we will use for specific damage or human safety concerns, or if the commission has given us the go-ahead where we want to manage a population, we have in some cases established a cougar target area and reduced a population, and in those cases we've had a combination of using wildlife services, hiring our own employees, or using the agents. So we have multiple ways of doing that. And you know, we don't set a population management objective for cougars at this point in time. We don't feel that we can do that at a fine enough scale yet, but we are working on that. We do have some things in the works that hopefully in the near future we'll be able to refine things and then take that to the commission, but we just aren't there yet.
Okay. Yes, Vice Chair.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a little bit of follow-up what Ron's saying, and maybe I can put this in a perspective, that I believe Ron shared with me and Kurt shared with me about the Heppner unit, where we had, all of a sudden, you usually have calf per cow retention rate of about 30 calves per 100 cows. Well, that dropped down to 15. So population dropped in half of the calf population. I believe ODF&W hired a couple of people or had a couple of agents go in and harvest in a two-month period some cougars, and the very next year it went back up to 30 per 100. So there is a balance there. We didn't go in and eradicate the population, but if you let the population go too far, it will in fact have a detrimental effect on your herds. Idaho is experiencing the same thing with wolves. If they get too many wolves in a pack or too many packs in an area, it drops that population sometimes as much as two-thirds. Where if they go in and thin that predator population down, then that comes back to where it was normally at. Just a tool.
And I'm frankly, I've had some discussions with folks who are concerned that there is not a report available right now of how we're maintaining the cougar population. And it seems to me that what Vice Chair Esquivel has just explained would be helpful for everyone to understand that these hunts, if you will, are provided for those kinds of controls. And I'm just wondering if that kind of report, if you will, would pose any kind of problem for the department.
Chair Witt, so are you referring to a report on the actual utilization of agents? Is that referring to it?
Well, I think more in terms of how this fits with the overall management objectives of the population.
Okay. Well, as Ron mentioned, right now, for cougars, we do not have a management objective.
Mm-hmm.
And the population is essentially on, we think right now, fairly stable.
Mm-hmm.
It's been over the last two decades on an increasing trajectory. It looks like it's leveling out a little mm-hmm. bit right now. Whether that's due to compensation or depensation, it's unclear at this point. But so annual report as it relates to cougar population management objectives, we don't have management objectives. Mm-hmm. So that would be obviously a difficult report to produce. Annual report on how we're utilizing these agents.
Uh-huh.
Relatively straightforward.
Okay, that's helpful. Thank you. Vice Chair McHugh.
Thank you, Chair Witt. Just for clarification, so I'm trying to get a sense of the kind of the how you're managing the numbers of the populations in the zones. You have a fair idea, but not a real clear idea of what's there. Is that what I'm hearing?
Chair Witt, Representative McCune, you know, I can let Ron go into any specifics, but my recollection is that the zone quotas were set based on kind of some observed harvest history in those areas. When you look at our, you know, when we look at the trajectory of the population over the last two decades, it's generally been increasing. In the early 90s, we had a population estimate, I believe, of around 3,000. We're now at about 6,000. So, you know, the commission has liberalized the cougar seasons. It's essentially right now it's a year-round season. Individual can purchase multiple tags. We have lowered the price. So a non-resident cougar tag used to be, I think, $100 or $60. We lowered the price down to $18 with the intent of having more individuals with tags in their pockets. People who purchase a sport pack get the cougar tag, you know, as part of the package. So we've really, from the under the current framework, we've really, as it relates to hunting and hunting seasons, we've really pretty much gone about as far as we can in terms of liberalizing.
I guess what I'm trying to ask, and I'm not articulating it particularly well, I don't think, is so when you hire one of your 27 agents to go out and take care of a population, that's reported by an individual who's had a problem. There's been a sighting, there's been some sort of damage done, somebody's come in and killed some sheep or killed somebody's calf, and so then you send someone out. It's not that you know that this population has overgrown by observation. You have to have somebody call you and say, I got a problem.
Chair Witt, Representative McCune, in the case of damage, absolutely. It all starts with the initial point of, you know, of damage, and then, you know, we assess and follow up in terms of what's the best appropriate tool. As Mr. Anglin mentioned, though, the commission has also authorized us to utilize these agents in broader wildlife management terms. So we have identified some target areas where we're actually going in and reducing or managing the cougar population, which is aside from specific any specific damage or human safety incident.
All right. Yes.
So, Chair Witt, if I might, the reporting that you're talking about, I think, is in context of the overall implementation of the Cougar Management Plan and all the different activities within that. And that is something that our commission obviously has an interest in. And from a Wildlife Division standpoint, we have multiple plans, species plans, that we implement under commission approval. And those are things that we used to have about every 5 to 8 years. We would have a review of those plans and go through a whole rulemaking. We've kind of set that schedule aside. And while we haven't completely got there yet, our intent is on a regular basis, whether that's every other year or whatever, we will be in front of our commission giving them an update on the Cougar Management Plan, the Deer Plan, the Elk Plan, you know, how we're implementing that, the goals and objectives, and provide that opportunity for public input, and then the commission, if they want to, direct us to reopen plans and address something different.
All right, great. Thank you very much, gentlemen. I'd like everyone to know, we have 10 minutes left. I have two more panels to get through, 5 minutes each. If you can help me stick to the schedule, I know that committee members would be most appreciative. I'd like to call up next, please, Jane Miller, Scott Beckstead, and Kevin O'Neill. Good morning to each of you, and welcome to our committee.
Thank you. Do we just go ahead and start?
Please decide among yourselves the order in which you're going to proceed.
Thank you. Representative Witt and board members, chair committee members, thank you for this opportunity to communicate with you. My name is Jane Miller. I represent Oregon Cougar Action Team, which is a 501c3 not-for-profit here in Oregon. And these bills are dependent on good data, and we're not getting that good data. In 2006, I was told by Ron Anglin that we had 6,000 cougar. It's not biologically possible to have 6,000 cougar today. The plan The Oregon Cougar Management Plan is a failed plan with a history of failed policies. And Oregonians deserve better than that. ODFW has not upheld Measure 18. And so far, these policies, bills for hound hunting, have only profited the poachers, of which Oregon has a chronic issue with. State of California has the same hunting policy as Oregon, and their cougar population has dropped to 1,600, like a rock. California has a ban on hunting cougar for decades, and they are a bigger state with more people, more livestock, and they only have 4,000 cougar, and their cougar are declining. Oregon does not have 6,000 cougar. We need an unbiased peer review of our cougar management plan and an accurate cougar count in order to be able to facilitate these bills as reflective of the most current cougar population. Right now, we cannot do that with any accuracy, and that undermines the process of these bills and good wildlife management. I would like to have you take a look at a DVD that was put together in 2006 regarding Oregon's cougar management plan. It's about a minute and a half.
Rights activists and the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife.
K2's Tom Jensen is here with the continuing coverage of the little cat and that controversy, Tom.
And it's a controversy over how and why these cats are killed and what some say is a plan to do it secretly, not scientifically. She's called Lucky. A four-month-old cougar kitten, now an unlucky statistic of what animal rights activists say is a broken plan.
This is wrong. The Oregon Cougar Management Plan is a bad plan.
Jane Miller is trying to make a difference.
Good girl. Good girl.
Not exactly your typical mountain lion lover, Miller grew up a rancher's daughter and still raises cattle today. From her farm near Turner, Miller created the Oregon Cougar Action Team and an organized fight to save the big cats. A fight that's taking dead aim at the 2006 Oregon Cougar Management Plan. The plan, says Miller, allows far too much hunting. The killing of 3,000 cats over a five-year period. Many of them female cougars with kittens who are left orphaned.
Abandoned. And chronically, tragically, and the numbers are going to increase.
In the area where Lucky was killed, Zone E of the plan, 128 cougars have been killed so far this year. 102 by hunters. Was Lucky the orphan of a hunter-killed cougar?
We have not, to my knowledge, had any female cougars checked in from this area that would indicate that a hunter killed the female.
But according to this report obtained by K2, 69 of the 128 cougars killed in Zone E this year were females.
I don't think that I'm being told the truth about what actually happened to this cat. I think
Miller says secrecy about cougar kittens facing euthanization is built right into the management plan, something ODFW denies.
No, we'll talk about euthanization with people, but it is something that in the best interest in the animal that you might have to utilize.
But under the heading cougar kitten handling procedures, ODFW employees are told all public contact and media attention will be avoided.
I mean, why the big secrecy?
Secrets opponents of the cougar management plan say are killing more mother cougars and their kittens every year.
We're actually killing our cougar now after Measure 18. Central Oregon is opening deep woods.
And furthermore, Representative Krager, cougars don't destroy trees. Bears do, so cougars really do need to get off the bear policies. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Who's next?
I'll go next. Thank you, Chair Witt, members of the committee. Scott Beckstead, Senior Oregon Director for the Humane Society of the United States. Briefly, by way of my background, I'm one of the authors of Measure 18, led the campaign to have Measure 18 passed. 2 years later, was the leader of the campaign to defeat Measure 34, which would have repealed Measure 18. The voters of Oregon twice overwhelmingly supporting the protection of bears and cougars from hunting methods that they viewed as unethical and unfair. You know, we don't view House Bill 23 as a full frontal assault on Measure 18, but here's the problem. When it was passed in 2007, this bill was highly controversial, and we felt
And I think a lot of wildlife advocates felt that it violated the spirit of Measure 18 because it essentially allowed trophy hunters, houndsmen, to engage in their sport under the guise of wildlife management, something that the voters of Oregon said they didn't want. So the problem is that now the Oregon Cougar Management Plan has essentially been put up on the top shelf, out of reach. We can't look at it anymore. There's no means for looking to see whether the management plan and this particular component, the use of state agents, is working. How much is it costing? How many cougars are each of these individuals taking? Is this an important tool? Is it achieving any objectifiably, determinable goals? We have no way of knowing. What I would recommend is that 2390 perhaps be amended to include some means for periodic review. And I mean meaningful review, scientific peer review that includes input from the top cougar biologists in the nation, as well as an opportunity for public comment. Because right now, cougars are highly controversial in Oregon. People have very strong opinions about them, and people want to have their input. And they just don't have that ability right now. So I would note that Representative Peter Buckley has introduced House Bill 3248, which reinstates the periodic review of all wildlife management plans. Perhaps 2390 could be amended by including some of that language, or at least that general concept. So with that, I'll thank you for your time. Answer any questions.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kevin O'Neill. I'm the Senior Director for the Western Region for the American Society of Protection, the ASPCA, Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. And for brevity's sake, since I know we're running late on time, a lot of the arguments have already been made, and we strongly oppose the measure as it's currently written, and the amendment that Scott just mentioned would be a good way. There's clearly an issue of accuracy of the information that's out there about cougars in Oregon, and more information, more sunshine on it needs to be done, and allowing this to just be completely gotten rid of, the sunset date, removes the legislature completely from oversight, and we would be strongly in favor of encouraging more oversight for the Cougar Management Plan and this program generally. So thank you for your time.
All right. Would any of you be interested in meeting with myself and the two vice chairs to further explore what you've suggested here?
By all means.
Okay, I just need to learn more about it.
We would appreciate the opportunity, yes.
All right, thank you very much. Can we quickly appreciate that? I'm going to ask that questions be held so we can get the final panel up here. Real quick, please. Al Elkins, George Houston, and Dave Wiley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Al Elkins with the Oregon Hunters Association. Scott was right about the petition banning cougars and dogs. However, in that petition wording, ORS 498-164 sub 2, the language states that nothing in subsection 1 prohibits the use of bait or one or more dogs by employees or agents of county, state, or federal agencies while acting in their official capacity. That's why we supported the original bill 2971 in 2007. That's why we support 2390 today. It's a great tool, and ODFW needs to continue to use it. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Dave Wiley for the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation. We support, and I won't reiterate, the Oregon Hunters Association position. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much.
George Houston, past president of the Oregon Chapter Foundation for North American Wild Sheep. Our team pretty much supports House Bill 2390. You know, hunting bighorn sheep and mountain goat in the state of Oregon is a once-in-a-lifetime privilege for us. But my members hunt elk and deer every time they get it. And management of large terrestrial predation on the ground for cougars and bears and wolves is absolutely critical to the success of the ungulate prey base. You know, if you look at the article in the paper yesterday about wolves in Wallowa County, it intimates that everything's fine if they're not eating cattle. Trust me, if they're not eating grade A beef, they're not eating popsicles. They're eating deer and elk. And we think that's really critical to the success of our overall opportunities to hunt deer and elk in the state of Oregon. Any questions or concerns? We're for House Bill 2390 and ODFW's continuing ability to use the cougar and bear control elements that they currently use.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. I appreciate your testimony and I appreciate your helping us keep this train close to being on time. With that, committee members, we're before this bill's worked, you're going to have another opportunity. I apologize for curtailing questions. We've run over time, but as I say, there will be another opportunity. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2390. Any last minute good of the order? With that, we stand adjourned. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Beth.